It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you read any good books lately? If you're like an increasing number of Americans, the answer is probably no. A recent study by the University of Florida and University College London found that pleasure reading has declined by 40% over the past two decades. The researchers speculate that the growing dominance of digital devices in our lives, along with economic insecurity and the lack of free time, have all contributed to the drop in reading. What do we gain from pleasure reading, and how can we make more time for it? To sort through some of these questions, we turn to Marquette University English professor Amy Blair. Amy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
This new survey, this recent study, indicates that, you know, pleasure reading is in free fall. Is it really? Does that surprise you?
I don't know that it really is. There's sort of always a push and pull about pleasure reading, and even about the idea of pleasure reading. The idea of pleasure reading itself has a history. It really goes back into the 18th century. Some people say that Robinson Crusoe was the first novel. My early modernist colleagues would put in a plug for Aphra Behn or John Bunyan. All three of these books are things that look kind of like nonfiction, but had lots of elements of imaginative literature. And one of the big concerns from the start of the novel was, is it even a good idea for someone to read something that isn't true? And this is actually, Plato was worried about writing, and that writing would enable people to begin lying about things like who they are, right? Things that happen in history. So he was very worried about the deleterious effects of writing, because if you wrote things down as opposed to just speaking directly to people, you couldn't really tell if it's true or not.
How dare you have creative flourishes?
Correct. And then, of course, also in the 18th century, there was a concern about particularly women reading, because even as we have Robinson Crusoe, which, I mean, if you think about it, too, the gendering of what you read is right there from the beginning. Robinson Crusoe looks actually a lot like things that were being published in the late 17th, early 18th century that were purportedly nonfiction accounts of exploration, right? So you have John Smith's narrative of coming to, you know, the colonies, and everybody says, oh, it's true. But then Robinson Crusoe is kind of like a little tweak on that, right? Taking this notion of nonfiction and making it fictional and sort of, you know, amazing. Women's reading was, you know, very early on. You see lots of, in early American newspapers, for example, people very concerned that women are reading books and they're not concerned with other duties, right? From the very beginning, reading books will take you away from the church. It'll just give you ideas, right? And that's, so I think most famously, Madame Bovary, right, reads novels, and she gets the wrong idea about what relationships should be like. And so she's never satisfied, right? And she enjoys reading books about them more than she will, you know, settle down and be a good wife. So the gendered tension of what should be read, what would be read for pleasure, the idea that maybe if you're reading for pleasure, that's going to be so addictive that you don't do, you know, housework or anything else that you're supposed to do. You know, it kind of waxes and wanes to the degree of, you know, also what are you supposed to be getting out of your reading when you read? So I want to say it's more like a cycle, right? Where people will read a lot and some people will say, oh, it's great to have pleasure reading. And then people will stop reading and others will say, oh, you really should be reading for pleasure. And then it's also a bit of a question of what are the right things to read and why. And so this is what my two books are sort of bookends about. In the age, like just before and at the very beginning of the age of sort of professional literary study. So people who do the thing that I do, which is teach literature mm-hmm. in a university, right? There's also a question of what's the good stuff?
Yeah.
What's good for you and what's not, mm-hmm. right? And you're not going to read the stuff that's good for you as pleasure reading, supposedly, right? My first book is all about how to choose the right books and actually to read the ones that are good for you. My second book, a woman named Emily Newell Blair starts writing a reading advice column in Good Housekeeping magazine and says, you know, this is at the moment like the 1920s, 1930s when we have sort of experimental high modernist fiction, right? So like Ulysses and Virginia Woolf and T.S. Eliot and all those folks. And she says, you know, don't bother trying to read it because all these people out here are telling you that's the thing you should read, right? Just go ahead and read whatever you enjoy.
Does that hold true to the now, to read what you enjoy? Like, what do you think about, you know, going down your own path and reading what seems to make you happy?
I think it's generational, too, as the parent of two young adults, and also somebody who sees them every day, obviously, in my professional life. There actually is a little bit of a resistance in general to all the reading, because at this point, I think the powers that be, or the sense that there's a cultural power that be that says that there are some things that you know, that you actually even just should read, right, at all. that's the thing against which people might balk, right? But I think that there still is a definite sort of subculture of reading for pleasure, right? Yeah. It may be niche. So I'm thinking of book talk. I'm thinking of people who are reading the sort of new romances like Colleen Hoover.
Romance is booming. Yeah.
It is booming. It is. Yeah. And also dark academia. So the kind of fantasy mystery from the Secret History forward, right? Donna Tartt's Secret History. It's all wrapped up in a particular kind of aesthetic, right? That seems to be the direction that my daughters are going in. But, you know, book talk has become extremely popular. And the idea is that these are people who look like you, sound like you, talk like you, who are giving you recommendations, yeah. right? There's also well-read Black girl who is talking specifically about African-American fiction largely. And, you know, so I think that idea of kind of entering into your niche of reading is appealing to current readers more.
But these young adults in your life, they're on Instagram, they're on TikTok. The things that are capturing yes. our attention, these are short clips
precisely.
In the scroll. And books are long and they might take more time to get into. So I wonder, does our attention span factor into this issue of pleasure reading?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm actually teaching this week even a portion of a book called Reader Come Home by a scholar named Marianne Wolfe. And she is a neuroscientist who studies reading and literature and sort of what happens when you read and what happens when you read in different modalities, like if you read on a screen versus in a book. And of course, Nicholas Carr is also thinking about this in Superbloom, Johann Hari, Stolen Focus. I mean, these are just some of the names that come to mind, and Anxious Generation has a lot to do with this as well, right? It is true that even this is a statistic actually that my students found fascinating, that basically in a day, I mean, we're so saturated with text, right? When we're looking at text, when we're looking on screens, you know, all social media, people are reading the equivalent of a novel a day.
Wow.
In words. But it's not sustained and continuous, and it's not following one plot, right, over a long period of time. And, you know, there is something being lost there. And again, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I find Wolf's book fascinating because one of the things she also says is that she's not a Luddite, right? Mm-hmm. And she doesn't think that reading on screens should stop or even can stop. You can't put the genie back in the bottle, but that she encourages people to become bilingual readers, right? And I even say to my students, you know, try to be trilingual readers. One of the things audiobooks. I spend, I mean, to be completely honest, majority of my reading now is audiobook because I can't, I just right now don't have time in my day to sit down and, here's what I'll say. It's not that I don't have time. I don't always make the time. It has to be a conscious effort to set everything aside, put things on airplane mode, right? Mm-hmm. Get in a chair, get a cup of tea and say, I'm going to read for this amount of time. To get into that state of what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi calls flow, right? Yeah. Where you're just absorbed. And now, see, that absorption is the thing that people were worried about in the 18th century. And now there's sort of a narrative of, you know, that has lamentably been lost.
I wonder, too, you know, pleasure reading and your economic means. I mean, you know, if you're trying to juggle bills and you're trying to pay for groceries this week and not overdraw, and then you're working a second job on Saturdays and Sundays, like, you know,
reading
I would
has, yeah.
low on the
yeah.
priority
reading has
list.
Reading has always been. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And that makes all the sense of the world. Reading has always also been very much about social class. It's been about accessibility. It's been about, you know, who is given the tools to read and why and how. So, I mean, there are amazing stories. Kathy Davidson writes about looking at lending libraries. Again, I'm going back to the 18th century, but talking about lending libraries where she can see that domestic servants, right, have in fact checked out books from lending libraries and have written, you know, or might, she speculates, read them to and from the lending library. But, you know, now it's, again, that's why I put in a plug for audiobooks insofar as you can. But absolutely, I mean, reading can be a very expensive hobby. So, you know, it's not always something that somebody can say, I'm going to set aside an hour at a time to read.
But what advice do you have for someone who says, yes, I would like to read more. I would like to, you know, spend some time or set aside some time. What advice do you have for that?
Well, actually, I had to do that myself. And I did it actually when I was writing my recent book. Unfortunately, I was just about to start a sabbatical for a year to finish the book, and then COVID hit, fortunately or unfortunately. But one of the things this meant is I kind of got off of the having to teach on Zoom thing that so many of my colleagues and students and my children went through. And when I sat down to start reading these middlebrow novels, some people would call them, right, the things that you don't, are not the modernist novels, I realized I didn't have any attention span left at all. So you had to really sort of retrain myself. And one of the things I actually also tell my students is, you know, try to think back on a book that you may have read in the before times, right? Or, you know, something, maybe this may be actually more appropriate to people who are, you know, Generation X and later, but something that you read back in the day, and pull it out and reread it and see where you're at, right? Rereading books is a really interesting practice because sometimes you forget huge chunks of things, or sometimes you see things differently in different stages of life. But this also is something that I've had some students do, like rereading Catcher in the Rye. So books have fortunes that wax and wane. I'm teaching a class on Moby Dick next semester. Moby Dick sold not at all when it was published, although, you know, some prominent figures thought it was great. And then for a long time, it languished in obscurity and then popped back up at the end of the 19th century and kind of went away again as unreadable and too long. And now it's enjoying a heyday. People do, you know, team reads and marathon reads of Moby Dick. And it's become kind of a popular class because it's hilarious. it really is. I promise you.
I'm not sure if I'm going to use that word for Moby Dick, but
oh, it is. Okay. It is. Okay. Yeah. But anyway.
Well, Amy, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marquette University English professor Amy Blair has two books on the role of reading in society.